Good morning. It is good to be together. My name is Gavin, and I serve as one of the pastors for our church. Happy Palm Sunday. It is Palm Sunday this morning. This is very much not a Palm Sunday text, but it is Palm Sunday. And child dedication morning as well. So congrats to all the families that have been prayed for and commissioned their children this morning. And go Blue Jays, eh?
Hey.
Hey-o. Anyone stay up late enough to watch the second overtime? I tried. All my kids were in my room. We had it on, and I fell asleep in the second half. Somehow, through all the cheering, I stayed asleep, but I saw the headlines this morning, so I will watch it later on YouTube TV. Hey, so this spring and summer, we're working our way through this New Testament book of 1 Corinthians, which takes us into all kinds of topics that are not normally preached on. And it's been fun waters, controversial waters, texts that you think, I hope Chris gets that one. And this is one of them. And so for the last 2 weeks that I've preached, I got to preach on litigation, lawsuits among Christians, super fun. And now conjugal rights, everything I've always wanted to preach on. So I hope you had a great week. My job's real fun. My life is so fun, so awesome. Been some doozies. Hey, this topic does, again, we let the text drive the topic. So this morning, we're talking about sexuality, specifically marriage, singleness, and divorce. We're going to hit on all of those things. Few preliminary thoughts I want to share before we dive into the bulk of the text. Number one, just to the parents in the room, I want to just state the obvious. This is a topic that we're going to address this morning, intimacy within marriage. You've got my commitment. I preach as though my own kids were in the room. I keep it very PG, but I also do need to talk about what the text talks about. So my phrasing will be as thoughtful as I can make it. You've got my commitment to not make it any weirder than it has to be. But that said, if these are topics that are not introduced in your home for age or other reasons, just a heads up, you can still check kids into kids ministry. Totally up to you. Number two, I also want to acknowledge the limitations of what we can accomplish discipleship-wise in a 35-minute Sunday sermon, okay? Why do I say that? I say that because as we talk about sexuality and intimacy and singleness and marriage, like this is a huge topic, and it really touches close to people's realities. And there might be areas here where you say, man, I would love to learn more. I feel stuck here, or this is an area we need to press into. And I just want to give the disclaimer that this is really not like a full marriage and singleness and sex like seminar. It's just a sermon on one passage. So I pray that it's super helpful to our church, but I also acknowledge you may need to go deeper into some other areas of the life of our church to really engage these topics in a more meaningful and deep and precise way. So here's just a little diagram I put together. As we think about the depth of topics that we cover in different discipleship spaces, this morning we are on that bottom foundational line, okay? Sunday sermon. We recognize there's all ages in the room, all maturity, believers, non-believers, and our commitment is to preach the Bible and really just lay out a biblical foundation for truth. What does the Bible say? But sometimes we need to go a little deeper on the topic, and so I just want to point you to city groups. Those are usually adults only, likely a more shared understanding of some of these baseline truths, and it can provide a deeper discussion to process different application. Third, there's classes and workshops. These are topic-specific training, focused equipping. We've got a marriage workshop coming up. I think it's April 29th. So there's other spaces in the life of our body that are more workshop-based that can really hone in. Also, we've got our huddles. These are gender-specific, authentic Christian community with confession and accountability. And then finally, we've got counselors on staff. We partner with licensed counseling organizations, and there may be areas that this touches on. You say, man, I really need someone to speak into my story, hear my story, and help me guide me through some next steps. Just want to encourage you to participate in the full life of the body. Sunday mornings are great. We can only get so far. Third, I also want to acknowledge the scope of this text, okay? So 1 Corinthians 7 is not like a one-stop shop. Give me the whole theology of God's design for sex, marriage, and intimacy. That's really not its intent. This is a theme that God introduces in Genesis 1 and 2 with our very first parents. This theme of family and intimacy and relationships carries all through the Old Testament, the Torah and the Psalms and the prophets. And so if we want to get a full sort of systematic understanding, we need to start in Genesis and get to Malachi and get to Matthew and get to Ephesians. And so this is not like a systematic theology of everything the Bible has to say about sexuality and relationships. But my primary goal this morning is what it is every week as we teach through the Bible, is to delve deeper into what is this passage specifically saying about the topic that it is addressing. So what is Paul addressing here? First, we need to ask, what is the specific context, okay? So first off, 1 Corinthians 7 is one of the most significant chapters in the Bible on the goodness of both singleness and marriage. He addresses this in verse 7. He says they're both a gift. One's a gift, another is a gift. Furthermore, the reason why Paul is speaking to this is that he's specifically correcting two wrongly held views that were being adopted and held by the Corinthian church, okay? And so the first one, Chris talked about it last week, I would call it a hedonistic view of sexuality. A common phrase in Corinth that was sort of a slogan that was being adopted in the church as well, we read it last week, chapter 6, verse 13, it says, "Food is meant for the stomach and stomach for the food." Now, what you need to know is that this was not a saying about getting a Snickers when you get hangry, okay? This is innuendo. This is a cultural slogan in Corinth about sexual desires. In other words, when you're hungry, eat some food. If you have a desire, act on that desire. That was their sort of cultural slogan around sexuality in their culture. It was a phrase that represented sort of de-emphasizing the relational, spiritual, emotional impacts of sexuality. It really just emphasized the biological act of pleasure for the body instead. And honestly, this is not a hard view for us to like really get our heads around, is it? This is very much a prevalent view in our own culture. Most of secular Western culture has also adopted a view that I would call a materialistic view of reality that sees the human body as a biological machine that can be purposed for any pleasure at will. And so in our own culture, we've seen this has led to hookup culture, hookup apps, premarital sex, cohabitation. It's sort of our culture. If you're hungry, you eat. If you have an urge, act on it. Our culture's only remaining ethic around sexuality seems to be consent. And this was largely the backdrop of secular or pagan culture in Corinth. Now, in today's text, a very different view of sexuality is going to get introduced, and I would call it the ascetic view. It's introduced in our very first verse, verse 1. It says, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote," so they had written to him, quote, "it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman," end quote. Now remember the context here. We are in the middle of a multi-letter correspondence between Paul and this church. And so if picture like an email thread, we're like scroll down. We're in the middle of several different emails. And so they're quoting each other. We don't have access to these other letters. But he is quoting what they have written to him. They wrote, "It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." And so, certain members of this church, probably as a reaction to this hedonistic view of sex, actually swung the pendulum to the opposite end of things. They rightly recognized that just because you have a desire, it doesn't mean you need to act on it. But then they took that line of thinking to the extreme. The thought was, well, if self-control is a Christian virtue, then certainly complete abstinence must be the most spiritual, the most virtuous posture when it comes to sexuality. So much so that this group of Christians in this church were actually advocating for abstinence within Christian marriage. Furthermore, some in Christian marriages were divorcing or advocating for divorce so that they could live lives of celibacy and abstinence, saying, this is the most holy way that we can devote ourselves to Jesus. Now, with these two voices going on in the church, can we agree there was some really jacked up confusion? Imagine the hearts and minds of these people that are just trying to get it right. Imagine the lives of these married couples. The gospel enters in and they're trying to navigate, well, which is it? How do we do it? Is it a hedonistic view? Is it an ascetic view of sexuality? And so Paul actually writes this section and he's going to shoot down the hedonistic view. He's going to shoot down the ascetic view of marriage. And he's actually going to provide some direction on what is holy sexuality. What does it look like to live out our relationships? What does it look like to live out human sexuality in ways that are according to God's design, that glorify him, and that lead to our flourishing as his people? And so as we engage this topic today of holy sexuality, I just want to point out this matters to all of us. As human beings, whether married or single, sexuality is a part of our lives. And God actually has a beautiful and good design for our understanding and experience of sexuality, no matter our relational status. And so it's our delight to learn God's design and to submit to his ways. We need to be very clear and very intentional to reject the views of sexuality that come to us through the television screen, social media, Hollywood, and we need to actually disciple our hearts, disciple our children in God's ways, so that we can prevent confusion, harm, and brokenness both in us and the generations to come. We need to do that unashamedly and also with great compassion and love. And then lastly, I also need to acknowledge, listen, there is no one in here who has batted 1,000 in this area. And so please hear my tone in this sermon. More so than that, please hear the tone of the text in this passage. Paul here is incredibly pastoral. His heart is not to condemn or heap shame, but his heart is to actually correct with grace, to point to Jesus, and to steer this church and these people that he loves into a holy and happy future of honoring King Jesus in every area of their lives. And that's our aim this morning as well. So let's hop into it. First, Paul is going to lay out a holy view of sexuality inside of marriage. He's going to talk about sex and marriage. Verse 1, he says, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, quote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, end quote, but because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband." So first off, Paul gives us something really important here. He gives us the context for human sexuality. He sort of assumes it in the text, but we can no longer assume that in our culture, which is that the context for human sexuality is always between a man and a woman who are married to each other, okay? If you get any part of that equation wrong, you've missed God's design. It's between a man and a woman who are married to each other. Any sex outside of that context is outside the bounds of God's design purposes for human sexuality. Now, you've maybe heard the analogy of a fireplace. Chris might have used it. I can't remember, but I find it helpful. The analogy is that a fireplace is to fire what marriage is to sex. A fire in a fireplace is a great thing. If it's in the fireplace, it can warm the whole home. It adds life and vitality and enjoyment to everyone who's in the home. It just adds a certain warmth and happiness in the home. You take that fire outside of the fireplace, and the very source of life and joy and flourishing actually becomes very dangerous. It can burn the whole house down, cause severe harm and incredible hurt. And so Paul sort of assumes this is the context between a man and a woman in the fireplace, in the context of marriage. But then he goes quite a bit further. Even within its proper context, Paul actually has a lot to teach us about sexuality in marriage. Three things he specifically points to: that God designed sex within marriage for mutuality, unity, and continuity. I'm going to hit them one at a time as the text does as we work through it. So first off, God designed it for mutuality. Again, verse 3, it says, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. Now, conjugal rights, that's not a phrase we use very much in our culture. The words translated into conjugal rights in the Greek, it literally says marital debt or your marital indebtedness. Now, I know that's not the most flattering or romantic language, but again, it's important to remember, he's not speaking to the nature of warmth or romance in relationship. He's not suggesting that sex is to be a transactional thing. So maybe don't ask your spouse if they want to celebrate their marital indebtedness as a pickup line. That may not go well. It's not what Paul is teaching us here. Instead, he's speaking to something very specific. He uses this language because he's talking about the selfless posture of service that God designed in sexuality between a husband and a wife. So here's what he's saying here: that the husband actually views himself as indebted to the physical desires of his wife, and that the wife actually views herself as indebted to the physical desires of her husband. The design is that there's to be mutual selflessness. Now, this is really important to understand here. Gordon Fee, Bible scholar, New Testament guy, he points out that the impetus is not you owe me. The impetus is I owe you. You catch that? It's very important here. In other words, notice that Paul doesn't tell the husband that his wife owes him anything. Paul does not tell the wife that the husband owes her anything. God's design is that both spouses see themselves as the selfless servant of the other, not that they view themselves as the recipients of the other's obligation. You tracking with me? When marriages get this wrong, it is a setup for all sorts of problems. We see it in marriage counseling all the time. The bedroom can become a place of selfishness and oftentimes even abuse. And so to make this very, very clear so we don't miss this really important verse, I've got a little diagram. Don't worry. There we go. So this is the language. This is the biblical view of obligation. The obligation between the husband and the wife is I owe you and I owe you. When this goes wrong in a marriage, when it becomes you owe me and the other believes I owe you, this is the context for abuse, domineering relationships. Joe and I, several of our pastors have counseled people in this exact same space. It's a very, very, very damaging and toxic relationship. This is not what the text is saying. Furthermore, the imposition is, or the impetus of the text is not you owe me, you owe me. This is actually selfish sexuality. This is actually kind of our common cultural view. If we believe this, we objectify the spouse. Everyone feels entitled to something. When interest starts to wane with age, there's frustration and bitterness starts to enter the marriage. But God's design is I owe you, I owe you. It's selfless mutuality throughout the life of the marriage. By the way, this would have been a radical idea to the Corinthians at the time. The culture at this time, as we've talked about in just the cultural context, it was one, a very male-dominated culture. Two, it was very stratified around power and status. And so if you have a man who is a man of means and status and power, he might have multiple wives, and all of those wives view themselves as indebted to the one with more power. And so it would not have been a controversial thing to say that the wife views herself as indebted to the husband. It would have been a radical paradigm-shaping truth for the husband to acknowledge you are actually indebted to the physical desires of your wife. It was absolutely revolutionary in the day. But it's God's design for intimacy in marriage from the very beginning. It's about mutuality, mutual selfless service. That's number one. Second, it's designed for unity. Unity. Look at verse 4. It says, for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Okay? Again, don't hear what this text is not saying. You cannot tell your spouse, married people, that you are the boss of their body. Okay? That's not what this text is saying. Here's what it's saying. The idea here is that when a married couple, or when a couple gets married, they exchange their autonomy from one another for a unity with one another. This has been God's prototype and design since the very beginning. Our first parents in the garden, Genesis chapter 2, it says that the two came together and became one flesh. One flesh. What does that mean? It means that the two people actually came together and formed a whole new person, as it were, a whole new identity. They come together in unity. And so, I think the best analogy for this unity actually comes from chemistry, which is a little bit out of my element, pun not intended, but kind of. That's pretty good. Thank you. Been a dad for 14 years now. There's more where that came from, but don't get me started. It comes from chemistry, and my degrees are in accounting and theology, so correct me if I'm wrong. We've got like some Creighton and UNO students here that are studying this stuff, but work with me. Salt, like table salt, is the chemical compound between two elements. Bonus points, who here can tell me the two elements that form table salt? Sodium and chloride. What an astute congregation we get to serve, right? Sodium and chloride. Now, what salt is not is just a mixture of like half sodium atoms and half chloride atoms, all stirred together. Like, you can't go on Pinterest and get a recipe for table salt and put half of this, shake it up, and now it's table salt. Like the Arnold Palmer drink, half tea, half lemonade, now it's Arnold Palmer. No, it's more significant than that. When a sodium atom and a chloride atom form a bond, a whole new substance is formed. It did not exist before. But in bringing together the two, there is a whole new one. That's the biblical idea of marriage. When my wife Sarah and I got married, May 13th, 2006, on a spiritual level, on a relational level, on a covenantal level, a whole new person was formed. One new family unit. The Bible calls it one flesh. Now, there's a million applications of this idea. It's not her money and my money. It's our money. It's not her body and my body. It is our bodies together. It's not my career and her career. It's our life that we are building and investing in together to glorify God. It's not a competition. Life together in marriage is not two people trying to build their own lives in parallel with the other one and trying to make it work. It's one flesh, it's one family unit. Again, this is another source of huge strain that we see in marriages that come in for counseling. When the marriage is seen as a contract for two people, we have two lives, we're contractually bound to stay together. We're in it. Divorce isn't an option. That's the Christian thing. But they view themselves as two lives running in parallel tracks with the covenant is really just a contract binding the two together. It creates all kinds of conflict. Everything becomes a fight that demands negotiation, compromise, from the calendar to the checkbook to sex to weekend plans to how we're going to engage with the grandkids. Two parallel lives contractually bound to stay together is not God's design. It's not two that stay together. It's one new family unit. It's one new flesh working as one unified family toward one unified goal to honor Christ. And so sex is designed to be a living parable of this unity. One flesh, one body. Sex is designed to be a mutually pleasurable experience and shared experience to celebrate this unity. It's not my body and her body. It's our body. Third, sexuality in marriage exists for continuity. Verse 5, it says, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So again, remember the context. To these ascetic, puritanical believers that Paul is combating here, they would largely say that sex is for procreation alone. It's never for marital recreation. Paul says, no, that's not true. Remember, their main view was that all of sex was bad, the most spiritual people abstained, that abstinence is the highest Christian virtue. And actually here, Paul is saying, no, that's not the case at all. In fact, he's saying, if you completely abstain, you're opening up yourself to more temptation, not less, for sexual sin. And so it's not more spiritual to abstain. In fact, if you're married, it's wise and godly not to. That's his point. It's even funny in verse 5, he does give this one exception for a more prolonged fasting, but did you notice how he qualifies it like multiple times? He says, well, perhaps, you know, like you can see him trying to hear their argument and concede something like, okay, I could see a case where for an agreed upon time and for prayer, you do this. But after that, you're going to come back together. That's his point. That God's design is for a certain level of frequency and continuity all throughout the marriage. Now, here again is where I want to refer back to my earlier comments about how far we can get in a sermon. What exactly does that look like? What do you do when there's dramatically imbalanced desires in the marriage? That's super, super common. Bodies and hormones change as we age. How does that come into play? What about physical disabilities? Common issue in marriages. What about past trauma that can influence desires dramatically? Again, super, super common in married folks. So if you're there like, this is my story, just know you're in the majority, not the minority, right? And so as Christians, we take these broad brushstroke principles, we say this is true and right, and now we overlay it into our own context, and prayerfully we discuss and consider together, how do we apply this? to build a home that's graciously built on love and care for one another. And sometimes this requires a little outside counsel and counseling from wise outside people as well. But broad strokes, Paul's saying that God's design for sexuality is inside of marriage, and it's designed for mutuality, unity, and continuity. But now in the text, Paul is quick to acknowledge, but not everyone's going to be married. Some will never marry. They'll be single their whole lives. Everyone is born single. No one is born married. And so all of us begin our lives, maybe spend the majority of our lives as single. Some will experience short seasons of singleness. Some will experience long seasons of singleness, either before marriage or perhaps after a marriage. And this was a significant portion of the population of the city of Corinth. And this is also a significant portion of the population of Omaha, Nebraska. Sarah Butenbach sent me some research. The majority of Omaha is single, not married. This is also the context of our church. Did you know the majority of our church, if you take out any age consideration, there are more single people in our own body than there are married people in our own church. And singleness, just like marriage, is a huge opportunity to bring glory to God through our human sexuality. In fact, this is where Paul goes next. He's going to lay out a holy view of sexuality inside of singleness. Verse 8, he says, "Now as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another." So it's pretty clear here, the Apostle Paul, he actually has a personal preference for singleness. He doesn't beat around the bush. He's not shy about it. He says, I'm glad that I'm single, as it were. Later on, he says, I wish that you were like me. And so he has a personal preference for singleness. But notice that he says both marriage and singleness is a gift. He's going to go into more detail at the end of the chapter, the end of chapter 7, about what he means by that. He means most succinctly, there's opportunity for both the single and the married person to serve the Lord. It just looks different. There's different opportunities in each space. We'll look at it in 2 weeks. But right here, he's very explicit that, listen, one is not varsity and the other is not junior varsity. Even though he has a preference, he's going to say both are a gift. I think it's important that we get that right in our church and our churches as well. It's good to have a high view of marriage and of family, because the Bible has a high view of marriage and of family. And it's also good to have a high view of singleness and celibacy, because the Bible has a high view of singleness and celibacy. I think probably at least in the last 50 years or so, perhaps longer, the evangelical church has kind of missed here. I think in having a high view of marriage, we have indirectly had a low view of singleness, which is not a biblical view of singleness. Paul affirms both here. And he actually prefers singleness. And so he gives us two specific ways that we can glorify God with our sexuality in our singleness. The first one is this: we glorify God through lifelong celibacy. Verse 8, he says, to the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. So, true or false, it can be good and God-honoring to be single your whole life. True, not a trick question. He says, it's good. I wish that more of you would, like I am. It's a good and God-honoring thing to stay single. Can you guys think of any influential single people that have brought glory to God in their life? How about Jesus? I heard it from the second row. You guys, we worship a lifelong bachelor, right? Now, he's coming again. He's going to get his bride. He's coming as a groom. But in his humanity, in his incarnation, he came fully God, could do whatever he wanted. He chose to be a lifelong bachelor and celibate. The lead pastor of our church and all churches is a single guy. The Lord and leader of our lives is a bachelor. How about this guy named Paul? Oh, we're reading him right now. He wrote the majority of the books in the New Testament. Most of what we know about God came, at least in the New Testament, was told to us by a single guy, by a bachelor. Some more modern examples: Corrie ten Boom, single her whole life. John Stott, one of the most influential theologians of the last century, bachelor his entire life. Now, notice here that Paul doesn't present singleness for what it's not. In other words, singleness is not just not being married. It's not the inverse of a positive. It's not lacking that which it does not have. It is by nature its own thing in the positive definition. Singleness is being a unique family unit who exists to glorify God as a nuclear family of one, as a part of a spiritual family of many. This is one of God's designs for family. In his book, Seven Myths About Singleness, that Sarah also recommended to me, Sam Alberry writes this. He says, Jesus is the most complete and fully human person who ever lived. So his not being married is not incidental. It shows that none of these things, marriage, romantic fulfillment, sexual experience, is intrinsic to being a full human being. The moment we say otherwise, the moment we claim a life of celibacy to be dehumanizing, we are implying that Jesus himself is only subhuman. Okay, so the idea here is that the Christian view of singleness isn't being less than married or half of a potential whole or pre-married or post-married. It is a unique and complete status with incredible opportunities for faithful ministry and a full and fulfilled life. And in singleness, the way we glorify God with our sexuality is celibacy. It's exercising self-control and obedience to Jesus, which, by the way, is also required in marriage. In marriage, we exercise self-control for monogamy. In singleness, we exercise self-control for celibacy. Both glorify God through self-control and obedience to Jesus. But Paul also concedes that singleness, for some people, will be a lifelong journey. For others, it will be just a part of their journey, not a lifelong status. And so for those people, they can live out holy sexuality and celibacy in pursuit of marriage. That's the second category. Verse 9, he says, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So for some singles, God will place in your heart a desire for a spouse. Say, I'm single now, and so I'm going to glorify God in my celibacy, but I have desires for intimacy, for family. And in that case, it's good and God-honoring thing to pursue a spouse. It's God's design that if you're a follower of Jesus, you would only consider other followers of Jesus. We need to build on the same foundation. And so what do? We remain celibate while we pray for, look for, and get to know someone who God would give us to be a spouse. This could look like courting or dating or friendship or whatever you want to call it. Just because we have that desire may not mean that God will ever bring that person. It's also the case that many people would love to be married, but God does not bring that person their way. But it's still a good thing to pursue and pray for that. Sex is reserved for marriage, but relationships can and should be built before marriage. They're built prayerfully, discerningly. They should be built in the context of Christian community, our city groups, our church family, so that we get outside input to discern fit and character. Are we a good match for one another? By the way, I heard a great adage years ago that stuck with me about dating and looking for a spouse. And this might be a word for some of the folks that are currently looking for a spouse. It was powerful for me. The quote was this: become the kind of person you're looking for is looking for. You catch that? Become the kind of person you're looking for is looking for. In other words, singleness is you're preparing for marriage. It isn't just evaluating other people and praying and waiting. It should be, like all of life, an intensive time of personal discipleship and growth. It's not a holding pattern. If you want to marry someone who loves Jesus, serves Jesus, is of high character, works hard, selflessly serves other people, then our period of singleness is a time where we are becoming that kind of person as well, focused on our character, walking with Jesus. But in all of this, Paul's point is that even if you're single and pursuing marriage, that singleness, again, it's not a holding pattern for marriage. It is a unique status that a sovereign God has assigned to you. He's assigned it to you to glorify him specifically as a single, whether that's a season or a lifetime. Again, we're going to look more in depth at singleness in 2 weeks. When we get to the end of the chapter, Paul has a lot more to say about marriage and singleness. But in this next passage, as we land the plane on our passage, he's going to end this section with a few comments on divorce. So finally, concerning divorce, verse 10. He says, to the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. Real quick, that can be a little bit confusing if you're new to this passage. With that little parenthetical statement, not I, but the Lord, Paul is saying that he is quoting the words of Jesus himself. And so if you know your Bibles, this is going to sound a lot like Matthew. He's actually quoting from Jesus' earlier teaching. So it doesn't mean that his own words are any less Bible or any less authoritative. He's just saying, let me quote Jesus for a minute. Quote, the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. Now again, to understand this, we need to hold it within its context. Don't lose sight of the context. Remember, what is Paul talking about in this passage? He is addressing something very specific. He is replying to the ascetic view of sexuality and marriage that said sex is bad. Don't do it. Don't do it even with your spouse. And the idea that if you want to be the most holy, you should actually divorce your spouse and commit your life to a life of celibacy. What is Paul saying then? He's saying, no, don't do that. He's saying, this doesn't even mean this is the Lord, right? And he goes back to say, listen, if Jesus said that marriage is to be a lifelong thing, then as a Christian, it is not a spiritual move to divorce your spouse so that you can commit your life to celibacy. Now, again, this is not everything the Bible has to say about divorce and remarriage. Jesus gives other exception clauses for divorce, for infidelity and abandonment. But again, Paul is not giving an exhaustive theology of marriage and divorce. His goal is to correct this view that divorcing for abstinence is not a spiritual move. It does not honor God. And he quotes Jesus to correct them. The holy sexuality is selfless mutuality and lifelong marriage, or celibacy and singleness, not divorce and celibacy. And then finally, he brings up another very specific scenario. What if one spouse becomes a Christian and the other one does not become a Christian? This was a very common issue in this local church because remember, the gospel has just come to them. And so it would be very often the case that one person would hear the gospel, respond to the gospel, and believe, and the spouse would go, what did you just get into, right? This is also a very common reality in our own church. What does Paul say about this context? Verse 12, he says, to the rest I say, I, not the Lord. Again, that parenthetical statement, he's saying, I'm no longer quoting Jesus here. And so he's quoting from his own words, but again, it doesn't make it any less authoritative or any less Bible, because all of the Bible, other than Jesus' words, were written by somebody else. Okay, you're with me. That if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife. And the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And so Paul's saying here, if you've met Jesus, you love Jesus, you know, walk with Jesus, and your spouse is not on board with Team Jesus, don't divorce him. That's his main point. He's saying if they're going to stick it out with you, stick it out with them. If they divorce you, there's not much you can do about that. But in so much as it depends on you, stay the course. And he points out that it's actually a tremendous blessing to your unbelieving family if you do get saved, even if they don't get saved right away. So maybe your ears perked up and your wheels started turning when he says that the unbelieving spouse is made holy by the believing spouse, or that the children are clean, or they would be unclean if you divorce, but as it is, they are made holy. Remember those words, holy or clean and unclean, are not always synonymous with salvation. Okay, we learned this earlier in 1 Corinthians. It's true here. He is not saying that your faith in Jesus vicariously saves your family. The word that he uses in both of those cases, holy, clean, is to be set apart. And the idea is that by you, believing spouse, knowing Jesus, you belong to the family of God. And so your family too has access to the family of God and the promises of God in a unique way. They were, as it were, set apart with you into this community of God and the word of God. And then he lands the plane in verse 16 by saying, who knows? Maybe your family will actually get saved through your influence, okay? So that confirms he's not talking about salvation. He's talking about a unique access that they have. And he's saying, man, stay the course. You don't know how this is going to shake out. Keep at it. And some of you guys in this room, many people in our church are right there. I know several people in our church body currently that love Jesus. They've been saved by Jesus. They walk with Jesus. And the spouse is like, nuh-uh. And the spouse, sometimes it ranges from like, very benevolent acceptance of that. Yeah, my spouse is a Christian. I think that if religion helps her, God bless her. I'll meet her for lunch after church, you know, no opposition. To the other end of the spectrum where it's actually a combative situation in the home. My wife has gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. My husband has left all sanity to believe this fictitious lie. But I also know that Paul is saying here, man, if that's where you're at, stay with your family. Pray for your family. Love your family. Serve your family. Don't badger your family. Don't annoy your family. Don't beat your family over the head with the Bible. That's going to have the opposite effect. But pray for your family. Stay with your family. Be a light to Jesus for your family. Some of the most beautiful testimonies in City Light over the last few years have been this exact scenario, where one spouse comes to know Jesus, and they patiently pray for and wait for the spouse. And sometimes it's even years later that spouse comes to know Jesus. And we've seen one spouse baptize another spouse. It's a beautiful story. It doesn't always end that way, but oftentimes it does. And that's what Paul's saying here. Stay the course. Pray for your family. Be a light to your family. So City Light, as I now try to land this plane, we covered a lot. We covered a lot. There's a lot of things going on here. I wanted to just press in two things as we kind of bring the plane in for a landing. And the two things are grace and opportunity. How do we respond to this? I think two ways are grace and opportunity. Grace, because again, I want to reemphasize, there is not one person in here who has not missed the mark when it comes to God's design for holy sexuality. And this area, for Christians especially, can be such a source of shame, guilt, darkness. Some of you are carrying on or holding on to things from your past that God himself has actually dealt with. If that's you, you need to remember there was one person who did hit the mark, and his name was Jesus. Jesus came as a single man, and he honored the Father's ways and the Father's words and the Father's will for his life in perfection, and he did it for you as a substitute. He came for sinners. He is the righteous one, and through faith you receive his righteousness. Furthermore, he died a brutal death. He incurred not only the pain of the nails, but the full wrath of the Father against all sin eternally for you and for me. Why? So that our sins could be removed and we could be white as snow. And so if you have placed your faith in Jesus, all of your guilt and all of your shame has been removed and dealt with on the cross. It came at a tremendous price for Jesus, and he did it because he loves you. And so would you walk in that freedom? Would we show each other that same freedom and grace? Second is opportunity. Opportunity, because like the Corinthian culture, our Western culture is now more confused than ever about family and sex and gender and where do we find identity and pleasure and joy. And just our lifetimes, we've seen the prevalent increase of more pornography use, the introduction and acceleration of transgender ideology, the flourishing of sexual hedonism. But simultaneously, and I would say commensurately, we have seen the dramatic increase in depression, disillusionment with human relationships, chronic sadness, suicide. And I think right now is our opportunity not to beat the world with our Bibles and outrage and anger that they've got it all wrong. No. It's our opportunity to actually live out a more beautiful human story that God has given us. Jesus has called his people a city on a hill. That means we're to be a city within the city. That's where our church name comes from, by the way. City Light, a light to the city, an Omaha within Omaha. And so we are God's alternate society, as it were, a redeemed and renewed city within our own city where we actually get to live out God's design, albeit imperfectly and needing tons of grace, but his design for relationships and flourishing. And as we do that, by the power of the Spirit, in community with one another, what an opportunity we have to a dark and decaying culture that God is the designer of life and the redeemer of life. And even our sexuality and our marriages and our singleness and the way that we relate to our bodies and one another, even that is a great testimony to the goodness of our God. And so would we live out this beautiful design? Let's hold each other accountable. Let's teach our kids how to honor Jesus in relationships and sexuality and in family. And would Jesus get all the glory as we, a little city on the hill, can live this out more faithfully in our lives.